I'm interested in knowing a bit more about, so you know, maybe just a bit about your experience with the court and how often you're dealing with allegations of child sexual abuse, and perhaps how many evaluations you've done, stuff like that.
Right. Okay. Yep. So, well, for the in the family court, the vast majority of families will resolve their issues without going to court. So only a small percentage, perhaps, you know, 5%, end up in court. And then of that, and probably only about 1% are the really highly conflicted cases. Mm. But they take up most of the court's time, that sort of 1% that are very highly conflicted. And they're the ones where they want often, you know, child psychiatrists or psychiatrists' assessment and opinion. And they're often the ones where there are allegations of abuse.
Mm. So. And is this something that you deal with quite a lot? Do you deal with child sexual abuse allegations frequently?
Yes, so that's quite a common. So domestic violence and or allegations of violence and allegations of abuse of the children or allegations of physical abuse of the children, I guess, common, really difficult issues that the court tries to deal with. And often they will want to get a specific expert opinion about what the allegations are about and how substantial they are.
Mm. So, from your experience, and how long have you been doing this?
25 years, yeah.
And how many evaluations, roughly?
A couple of thousand, probably, I've done, yes.
So you're well experienced and you've done a lot of this.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I imagine you've seen how this has progressed over the years, the kinds of allegations that have been coming to the court?
Look, I think the allegations of abuse have probably been around for many decades. So, and, you know, where you've got highly conflicted couples, you know, fighting over children, then they will look at what is likely to be substantial reasons for them either keeping the children or the other person not seeing the children. And so that might be due to, normally it would have to be due to a substantial reason such as abuse.
Mm-hmm. From your experience, do you see what retired Judge David Collier said was an increase in mothers faking allegations of child sexual abuse to gain an advantage over their ex-partners?
Well, look, I think that it's complex because I don't think it's just a simple case of mothers making up allegations. I think that what we do see is that not all allegations are true, but also not always are the beliefs of parents about abuse true either. So I think we see a mixture of intentional allegations to try and gain advantage against the other parent, but sometimes we see incredible amount of anxiety about letting children out of their sight, and that anxiety fuels their beliefs that the child's at risk, and then this can set up a cycle of anxiety, questioning of children, eliciting answers from children that are unclear, and often parents don't have the sophistication to know how well children might be able to report what's happened and what hasn't happened, and then this confirms their own belief system, and often they develop their own illusion of validity about abuse.
And so how do you go about assessing whether allegations of child sexual abuse are founded or unfounded?
So, well, I guess the way to start is to start in a neutral position. And I think it's a different approach from, say, the children's court or in the general community, where concerns about possible abuse, one needs to be, I guess, highly tuned into the fact that abuse is underreported in the community. Whereas in the family court, I think one needs to start from a neutral position. One shouldn't be presuming that there is a very high risk or a low risk. One needs to be prepared to look at all of the information and then to come to a considered position. And so it involves assessment of all the adults involved, which may be partners, may be grandparents, who are sort of intimately involved with the children. It also involves assessing the children, and then it involves the interaction or understanding the dynamics between the children and each of the adults, and also, if possible, the interaction between the actual parents themselves.
And so what is it about a child's behaviour and perhaps their interactions with their parents that gives you clearer indications of whether abuse has occurred?
One cannot just depend on what the child's statements are. So often this is seen as the gold standard for trying to decide whether abuse has occurred, whereas in the family court, one has to be cautious about just accepting at face value child statements, because often what happens is children are interrogated by the anxious parent over and over, and as children develop, they at certain ages they will try be attempting to please their parent, and so they're not so aware of what is in fact fact, but they're more worried about producing what they think the parent wants to hear, and so they might be making statements that the one parent will want to hear. So that's why it's important when doing an assessment to see the children individually, and then also see the children with each of the parents, and then to openly talk about what has been alleged.
And do you talk about, say, for example, if the child is in the room with the mother and then the child is in the room with the father, can you talk about what's been alleged in front of both parents with the child there?
Yes. Yep. So I will talk with the child on their own, and then I'll talk with the child with each of the parents, and then I'll talk with the parents together, and talk about, you know, the particular concerns that the children and the parents have got. And generally by the end of that whole process, one's able to form a view about particular influences and the dynamics that's happening within the family, between the family members. Also, it's important to look at the previous material that's been led to investigation. So often police and community services and particular investigations have been done by other professionals, to look at all of that material as well, to then weigh up with, come up with a weighted view about what's likely to have happened. And there is no gold standard or litmus test that one can use. You know, there's no particular test that says a child's been abused or not. Mm. So one has to look at the situation, then form a view, and then develop on balance of probabilities, is it likely that abuse has occurred or not?
Mm. And so when you interview, say, a child in front of perhaps the parent that's had the allegation made against them, what are you looking for in terms of the dynamic between the child and that parent to assess the validity of the allegation?
So usually one's looking at how the child relates to that parent, and if the child has reported information separately, then one might bring up the information that child has raised individually with the parent where the abuse allegedly may have occurred. And if abuse has occurred, generally there's an awkwardness and some representation of that difficulty that will be discussed between the child and the parent. If there is no substantial sign of abuse that might have occurred, then generally one can tell if a child and a parent has a good rapport and the child's relaxed, or if the child's frightened, it gives you strong information. So you have to look at the non-verbal information that you're observing as well as what verbally is reported.
It must be awkward to ask a child, especially a young child, in front of a parent that they've talked about sexual abuse with. It must be awkward to ask that child in front of that parent, you know, details about the abuse. Is that difficult for you as a job?
It is difficult, yes. It's not an easy thing, but one generally asks broad questions first about how comfortable the parent is with the child, and then whether there's anything that's happened that may have been uncomfortable, and also ask the parent about whether the child might understand what the situation is. And often parents are confused about what's been alleged against them. And I think it's important to, but it's important to allow that conversation to occur between the child and the parent, so that there can be some clarification for them, and that's often helpful during the assessment.
If the abuse allegations are true, is there a problem of if the child is talking to the person that they've said has abused them, that may be traumatic for the child?
That's always a concern, and in other jurisdictions, it's probably not always wise to interview a perpetrator and a victim. However, if one's looking at the family court, I think it's a different jurisdiction from looking at, say, the children's court matters, where abuse is one of the major problems in that jurisdiction. Allegations of abuse is a big problem in the family court, but the actual rate of abuse is far different from the children's court. So one cannot presume that abuse has occurred, and just as much damage can occur to children by denying a relationship with a healthy parent as there can be by perhaps exposing a child to a parent who may have victimised them. So there's a balancing act.
And is that, in when you talk about that, are you talking about in terms of custody or residence? Like that if you deny a child's relationship with a parent in terms of custody, if they're a healthy parent, then that may have just as much impact as putting a child perhaps in custody with someone who may have victimised them?
Well, I think there are different potential harms that can occur, particularly in the family court. And if you just accept the one parent's allegations against the other parent through the child, then a lot of harm does occur where children are denied of a relationship with the other parent. And I guess classically, you know, it's the mother making allegations against the father and fathers being excluded from children's lives, but children losing that relationship with a parent that might have been very close to them.
So in your opinion, how reliable are children's disclosures? Are they easily led or more open to suggestion than adults?
Children are very easily led, so it depends on the age of the child, and children at different ages understand a lot more or a lot less. So up to the age of 7 or 8, children are in a magical stage of thinking. You know, they believe in Santa Claus and they believe in fantasy, and their main aim then is to please their parent and make them happy. Children between about 8 and 13 are more aware of logical thinking, and they're able to report fact better, and they're often able to understand, you know, what has and hasn't occurred, but are still very much under the influence of parents. And then children in their teenage years are more able to think like adults, and so are more able to represent accurately what's happened. So one has to sort of take into account the age of the child. But often what's very worrying is when children of 3 or 4 are reported as making sexual abuse allegations against the other parent, where in fact it's very difficult to be able to interview children of this age and get an accurate verbal account of what might have occurred. And often it's better, rather than forcing a child to give an answer, to allow things to be unclear.
Mm-hmm. And so for kids who, like, I think it's generally under 10, aren't they, the kids that come through the family court? In most cases, they're quite young. Is that...
Well, up to about the age of 12. Above the age of 12, often children are regarded as being able to be more able to represent their own views, but mm-hmm. up to about the age of 12.
So I guess in that under 12 sort of age bracket, and obviously it's different for like 0 to 8 and then 8 to 12, or would a child make a sexual abuse disclosure spontaneously if the sexual abuse had not actually occurred? And how easy would it be for a parent to coach a child to do that?
Well, I think there are probably two scenarios. And one is where a parent is intentionally trying to extract a a disclosure from a child and then have that reported to an authority to be able to maliciously deny the child some contact with the other parent. Now, I think that does occur, but in my experience, it's certainly in the children, the families that I see, it's probably less common than the next group, which is where you've got an anxious parent who has...
Less common than the other group.
Than the other group, where you've got an anxious parent who unwittingly is checking on their child and asking their child about the other parent. And by repeatedly asking a parent about a child about another parent and then quizzing the child, often that will elicit responses from that child that makes the parent even more anxious. And then if the parent has some concern about a particular form of abuse, perhaps sexual abuse, parents are not very adept at being able to do disclosure interviews with their children. So what they do unwittingly is modify the child's answer and actually develop a gradual evolution in that child's disclosure about what the parent fears may have happened, and unwittingly come up with the answer that the parent fears, which is that the child has been abused. And so it becomes this reinforcement process where the parent eventually gets from the child their fears and they develop an illusion of validity, is what I call it, where the parent and the child have both making these statements to each other about what they fear is true, and then it becomes accepted between the parent and child about what is true, which may have nothing to do with the facts.
Mm. What about children who perhaps make disclosures at school, you know, at first rather than to parents?
Well, I think that's probably different. If children make a disclosure that has not been prompted through anxiety and questioning, then that can be quite different.
Do you see often in your evaluations that children under 12 are making up or exaggerating allegations of abuse? Even if it's the influence of the parent, not necessarily of their own, you know, but...
I think in the family court there are, in this very severe, highly acrimonious group where parents are making allegations against each other through the children, that there are a lot of false allegations in that very small 1%.
Mm-hmm. So where sexual abuse allegations come up in the family court, a lot of those allegations you're seeing do turn out to be unfounded?
Yes, but this is a very select 1% of the matters that go through the family court. So of that very severely acrimonious group, a lot of those are false allegations. But that's not to be looked at as representing the community where there is a lot of abuse that occurs in the community. But I think one cannot transform the concerns about abuse in the community to that 1%. You need to look at that 1% as a very specialised area.
And so the 1%, is that the total number of parents that come through family court with allegations of child sexual abuse? Is that about 1% of the whole...?
Well, that's the 1% of the matters that go through the court are the very severely high conflictual cases.
What about things that, I guess, are there other allegations of sexual abuse that go through, say, the Magellan list and other places? Or are there other types of child sexual abuse allegations that get dealt with in the court other than this 1% that you're talking about?
Not all of them go through the Magellan, but a lot of them have gone through the Magellan process by the time they get to be seen in my situation.
Okay, so you're seeing both people who've gone through Magellan and people who've not been put through Magellan.
Yes.
And just so that I have that in my head, so in total, the child sexual abuse allegations in family court equal to be about 1% of the total sort of caseload for family court.
That's not an accurate, but that's a guesstimate, yes.
Okay. Just so that I know that we're not talking about a specific subset of child sexual abuse allegations, but the whole set of allegations equals about 1% or roundabouts 1% of the whole case.
I think so, yes.
Okay. So
I think 95% of matters that go through the court don't involve allegations against the other parent, and then of that 5%, then there are concerns about possible maltreatment by the other parent, but it's not as highly conflicted. But then this very narrow 1%, there are major problems.
Now, has there been any data done on how often false allegations are made in the family court?
It's very difficult to get good data on that. It's well recognised that false allegations have been part of the court process, family court, for decades. So it's well recognised that allegations of abuse. But what often happens is, because of the community standards and fears about abuse in the community, I think this often clouds the researchers' views about abuse in the family court. And there's a reluctance to see the family court as being a special case, because it may do an injustice to the abuse concern in the broader community. So I think there's a tension between the researchers' views about abuse in the community, which is a major problem, and abuse in the family court, and wanting to, you know, the fear of invalidating people who have been abused. But in my mind, you know, the family court is a special situation. It is an adversarial situation, and there's a lot at stake, and parents are prepared to follow things through to in this very narrow group to a high level of conflict, and often at the jeopardy of their own children.
What do you think? I mean, obviously not giving me a number, but, you know, what share of the cases that you look at that involve child sexual abuse do turn out to be unfounded roundabouts?
So in my experience, about 90% are unfounded in this very narrow, small group that are highly conflicted. So there is still sexual abuse and physical abuse that comes through, but a lot of the people who end up in the family court are highly motivated people and highly competent people. So they're a different group from, say, the lower courts or the children's court.
And how would you advise a parent to act if they were absolutely certain that abuse had occurred, either through disclosure or through direct witnessing, but had no concrete proof and they were already in a custody battle?
Well, it is very difficult. They need to get professional assistance, and they need to be prepared to allow professionals to do their assessments and then accept what the professionals provide to them. That parents, when they're highly emotionally invested, are not the most objective people to be able to make a judgment about what's safe and what's not safe. Mm. And so if people want 100% safety, then, and they want to be 100% sure, they're not going to be able to achieve that. They need to be able to achieve a reasonable degree of safety and surety that can be provided by independent objective assessment from professionals. And there are a group of people that are much relieved when the assessments are able to assure them that abuse is not occurring and that they can quite safely share their children between the parents. But a lot of these highly conflicted cases are very angry when professionals try to reassure them that their child's not being abused.
And, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it? Because sometimes professionals will come to different conclusions, like child safety might say, oh, it is substantiated, that there's a risk. Police might say it's not. A psychiatrist then might say we're not sure. Or, you know, like, so how do you, who's, I mean, in terms of the court, who amongst child safety, police and expert psychiatrists are kind of the most reliable experts in this field, because it can be difficult to navigate all of these different opinions.
Well, that's why we have a court system, and so the court will look at all of these opinions, and as you say, there are different professional and expert opinions that may conflict with each other, and so then ultimately the court will have to make a judgment about whether there is an unacceptable risk. Generally, the, I guess, independently appointed experts have access to all the information and try and are not influenced to try and support one side or the other, except support the what's best for the child or children. And so often the independent expert has that best opportunity to provide advice to the court. But still, there might be other information that comes to light that can change that opinion, you know, throughout perhaps a court hearing that could make a difference.
And what about, I mean, in terms of the way that police and child safety organisations or child safety agencies interview children, do you have any concerns with the types of outcomes that come from those interviews and how they're conducted and what types of outcomes are looked for?
I do have a lot of concern about that. I think what happens is that the agencies, community services and police, are interviewing the whole spectrum of cases. And so often they're coming from a community concern about abuse perspective. And they may have a highly conflicted family court matter ending up in a hospital where a parent has driven their child to make disclosures, and then the community services and the JIRT, often it's the Joint Investigation Response Team, are in a situation of having to do an assessment with the child and making a judgment almost purely on what the child is reporting or what the anxious parent is reporting. And so sometimes these assessments are highly influenced by other factors.
Like what in particular?
So where a very anxious parent who says that their child has reported sexual abuse will present the child to the police to report what the child has reported to them. And this may have been a process that's been conducted over many months with that anxious parent, and the child will repeat those statements to the police. And then the police have to make a judgment as to whether the child's statements about being abused or touched by the other parent require response and perhaps charging the other parent.
And what do you look for in, say, the behaviour of the child and in the behaviour of the parents that will give you a sense of whether this anxiety-led sort of disclosure has occurred or whether the disclosure has actually been from the child themselves and is founded?
If it's early in the process and the child has made a disclosure to an independent person that it's come up in as an unprompted occurrence, and then it's been investigated as you would in the community, then that would hold a lot more validity than if you've got a highly charged emotional state between the parent and child and where there's been a lot of questioning of children after visits with the other parent. Often the parents will be honest and say, well, I've worried about sexual abuse, and so I've been checking my child, taking photographs, questioning the child, and then the child has eventually told me this. Often the parents will even admit that initially the child said nothing happened, but after several months of questioning, the child eventually did disclose something. So one can get a picture of whether there's been an evolutionary process in questioning, giving you an answer, or whether it's something that's happened in a more innocent way and then abuse allegations have come out in a more de novo setting.
Could that be, though, that because children obviously take a long time to disclose sometimes, could it be that at first they do say no and then over time when they feel more comfortable to say something that they might disclose?
Well, this is often the community standard where children who possibly have been severely abused and are showing signs of distress and are reluctant to talk about what might have happened to them may take some time to then disclose what has actually happened to them. And so if you apply this standard in the family court, it can be very confusing.
And so what do you think is different about family court cases that's different to the community cases in terms of when a child would disclose or not?
Normally, it's in the context in the community of a child who's showing some signs of behavioural or emotional disturbance. There may have been some untoward behaviour in the child that suggests that the child has had something wrong, you know, something bad happened to the child. And so it's in that context that the child is in need of care, and often it takes the child some time to be able to get confidence to in a caring environment to get the confidence to share, you know, what abuse could have occurred. In the family court situation, often children are quite happy and relaxed with their individual parents, and it's only the other parent who's worried about the child, and it's in that context of questioning the child about the other parent, even though the child may have been functioning quite normally, that the parent elicits information from a child who otherwise is quite happy, healthy and normal.
Mm. So, oh, yeah, this is something I'm interested in, is when you see a history of domestic violence with a couple, does that tell you anything about the likelihood or not of child sexual abuse having occurred? Are there any connections between domestic violence and child sexual abuse?
I think generally speaking, violence in the family court, I think, is also another specialised area. There's often allegations of violence between parents, and one needs to, I think, also look at the motivation behind the allegations of violence from the other person. And again, often it's to gain advantage over one parent or the other. And that's not to say that, again, in the community, there's a lot of concern about domestic violence, which is a very major community problem that one has to be aware of. But applying that standard in the community, again, in the family court, where there's meant to be a different threshold, needs to be thought through carefully. Now, if there's a lot of abuse in the community of physical violence, then often sexual abuse may be another form of abuse. So in the community, yes, if there's domestic violence, then there's a higher risk of sexual abuse or all forms of abuse. In the family court, I think one needs to be looking at the whole situation in a very balanced way and look at it neutrally at first before putting one's picture together.
Mm. And what's the difference between in the community? Because I imagine that, like, say you've got a family in the community who've had domestic violence occur, then they divorce, and then, say, the perpetrator or the abuser wants to gain custody of the child, the victim does not want to give custody of the child, they end up in the family court, and there's obviously, that's going to be a pretty acrimonious relationship. So what's different about their situation now that they're in the family court compared to what it was in the community?
Well, I think that it's there is obviously an overlap, so it is quite a complicated situation. And where there has been a great deal of violence between parents, then there is a higher risk of children being exposed to violence and abuse. However, it's usually pretty obvious, and it's quite well documented, and it's not an area that has a lot of doubt usually.
How can you tell what's the obvious?
Because police have been involved, hospitals have been consulted over abuse or over physical damage, and there's often a history that is quite clear-cut about the level of violence that has occurred and the harm that's occurred. Now, often in the family court, we're seeing cases where there are allegations that this has happened, but there isn't a lot of evidence to support it. Mm-hmm. And that often will create a different category that one has to be aware of when trying to assess these matters.
So if there was, say, for example, an example of domestic violence that did have AVOs and things like this attached to it, and police interaction, but there had been no evidence of child sexual abuse until after the parents had separated, would there be... Is there any connection between this history of domestic violence and perhaps the existence of child sexual abuse after the separation has occurred?
Well, look, I think that's quite difficult to answer. But if there's been a high level of acrimony and violence between parents, and there's been no concern about sexual abuse, and then one then later in the family court finds that there are allegations of sexual abuse, I mean, one needs to then approach that in a neutral way initially, and then try and put the picture together to decide whether that's likely to have occurred or not.
Mm. Now, so if you do get a report from police and child safety saying that there's an unacceptable risk of harm, is that enough for you to assume that there is a risk of harm?
Not necessarily. I think if the one obviously takes very seriously what the police and community services have found, and generally speaking, the way community services and the police approach these situations, I think, is professional and well conducted. However, it is important to review the transcripts and also to look at the actual videos of disclosure interviews to be able to sort of look at the context of how this JIRT interview, or Joint Investigation Response Team interview, has occurred, and the context in which it's occurred, to be able to form a view about the broader picture of what's happening. So one is influenced significantly, or I'm influenced significantly, by what the police and community services have found, but I won't accept their view only. It would be in the context of the whole assessment.
When you're interviewing, say, for example, the alleged abuser, are there any common traits that you look for in somebody who would have been more likely to abuse a child than not?
Yes, people who are more likely to abuse children are people who have substantial personality disturbance. And so often you get a history where the person has had a very traumatised childhood themselves, and they've often had a very troubled youth, and then they've had a lot of problems with the law, and often they've got significant antisocial or behavioural problems, and that this has continued into their relationships with partners and also their relationship with children. So if one has the opposite history, where the person's had a very healthy upbringing, they've been very competent in their profession, they've had competent relationships, and then they're being accused of major abuse of children, then one has to be able to try to explain that disconnect between their earlier life experiences and behaviour and what appears to be quite different now.
And what about the common pathology of, say, a mother who's made an allegation that appears to you to be based on anxiety? What are the sort of common traits of that parent?
So that parent cannot be reassured. They're often over-anxious about the child in many different settings. Some parents are very anxious about even letting their children go to school for fear of people at school abusing their child, or sometimes they're anxious about anyone else seeing their child, sort of that at the extreme end of the spectrum. And then there are other mothers who have had a particularly unfortunate relationship or experience with the father of the children, and their anxiety is totally concerned about that person, and no amount of reassurance is likely to be able to help that parent separate what their personal experience with their ex-partner was from perhaps understanding that their relationship is different from their child's relationship with the other parent.
So where you do find that, that say, for example, let's just say mothers because that is the most common. I know that's not 100% of the time. But where you do find that there is an unfounded abuse allegation, what sort of action would you recommend around custody or around potential, I don't know, like maybe counselling for the mother? Or what types of things would you recommend to the judge?
Well, usually I would recommend that if there is not an unacceptable risk for both parents, that the parents be reassured that the children are not at undue risk, and that then there should be a process of perhaps increasing the amount of time with, say in this case, the father, so that the mother has a chance to gain some confidence and the mother's anxiety be managed, and perhaps with psychological support and therapy, the child and the mother's anxiety be managed, so that more and more time with the other parent up to a reasonable amount can allow a process of accommodation and acceptance.
And if you were, I mean, I imagine there must be a lot of cases where you're uncertain. Are there cases that you look back on and you wonder if you made the right call?
Obviously, when one's doing an assessment, you're taking a snapshot of children and parents. And it's also an artificial situation, coming to an office, doing family interviews, looking at relationships and snapshots of interactions. So I'm always mindful of the fact that more information may change my opinion, and that it's always possible to get a false impression, and in a relatively, even though these interviews go over a number of hours, it's still possible to get a misjudgment about what the interactions have meant. So I'm always mindful of that.
Mm-hmm. Now, in some cases, it seems the alleging parent can be told if they repeat sexual abuse allegations that custody might have to be transferred to the other parent. But how can you be sure that the allegations are false from these interviews? And can this trap the parent and child into a sort of silence if the allegations are not false?
I guess the problem is that the courts are held to ransom by what is a possible risk of making a mistake. And I think that this is a huge problem for the family court. So allegations of abuse are made by one parent that may well be spurious, and yet the court is so anxious about possibly making a mistake that they often stop contact with the other parent until this can be assessed further. And this may cause children's relationship to be interrupted quite significantly over months, sometimes years, and sometimes forever. So I think one needs to be balanced and understand that there is no absolute test, but one needs to use a common sense approach, and that if children have a good relationship with the parent and there is no substantial reason to stop contact, then it's important to, as quickly as possible, reinstate contact.
But what about if, like in these cases where sometimes someone might be told that if they do make a child sexual abuse allegation again, that the custody will be transferred to the opposite parent? Is there a risk that in saying that they can't make any more allegations, that if more information comes up, that they're then sort of restricted from being able to present that to the court?
If more information comes to light, then it's always possible for parents to bring that information to the authorities. So, but it would seem that in these cases where you've said, you know, the recommendation is a change of residence, that usually these cases it's quite clear in the court's mind that abuse hasn't occurred and that the parent is not an unacceptable risk, and that the parent making the allegations has become so obsessively anxious that they can't stop themselves from making further allegations. And in fact, they're exposing their child to the harm of further investigation, often genital examinations and interrogations with police, that in fact the court's worried that that parent is doing more harm to their child, that it may require that the child be with the parent who's not going to make allegations.
So I think there's just a couple of questions I wanted to ask you. Is there still, like, there's references to parentification, brainwashing and similar types of terms in judgments. Where do these theories come from in the literature, and who are the experts that you refer to when you're forming opinion on the case amongst sort of child sexual abuse experts?
Well, the literature is really based upon experts in the field who've developed their own experience, and it's a very difficult area to get objective information and to carry out controlled trials. So the scientific literature is really a combination of looking at very experienced, well-regarded people in the fields and looking at their opinions and their experience. And so often it's really looking at eminent people.
Is there anyone in particular?
So, well, I mean, there are various people who've looked at various syndromes. So Gardner, for example, looked at the parental alienation syndrome. And there's been a lot of debate about the use and misuse of parental alienation syndrome. But clinically, often we see children who have become distanced from the other parent under influence, and so develop a degree of alienation. And I think that's a useful concept in some circumstances, but it's sometimes overused and misused. The term parentification originally came from one of the early family therapists, Salvador Minuchin, who talked about seeing children being parentified and taking care of the parent rather than parents taking care of the child. And that's often a dynamic that one sees, particularly in older, in young adolescents or the older sort of latency age children who are worried about their parent, and so they start to become parentified. So I think that they're useful concepts, but one needs to look at them clinically.
And do you think that, say the theories of Richard Gardner, for example, may have been unfairly maligned and sort of cast out, where they may still have some relevance?
I think it's very relevant, but I think one needs to specifically not just throw that term parental alienation syndrome. One needs to actually describe what one is seeing clinically, and then say talk about the degrees of alienation, which Richard Gardner talked about as, and I think that that's useful, where there's, you know, mild, moderate, or severe, and that may sort of lead to an appropriate response from the court.
And in terms of the influence of experts, what do you think in terms of report writers that you talk to and fraternise with who do reports for the family court, who do you think are the sort of most influential experts or theories that really influence a lot of a psychiatrist when they're trying to make these reports?
Look, I think one has to be quite eclectic, I think, and I think one has to look at, the development of children, and so I tend to use a developmental model in understanding where children are at in their stage of their own personal development and how that could be influenced by the stage and by the circumstances of the family. One needs to look at the systems theory, so in terms of how a whole family system can be influenced by what's occurring within the family and how every person in the system is influenced by what is happening to other people in the system. So if you look at the family as a small system. And then I think there's psychiatric illness, and a lot of the families that I see, one or more have a psychiatric condition that could be influencing the behaviour, and so whether that psychiatric condition is being treated appropriately. So I think there are a combination of medical conditions that one needs to be aware of. There's a combination of developmental theories that are also important, as well as systemic theories.
And what about the specific study of child sexual abuse and its impact on children? I imagine the family court has some pretty strict guidelines around expertise in that particular area. What is your particular training and expertise in that area?
So I think as a child psychiatrist, I've not only trained in adult psychiatry, but then do further training in child psychiatry. And a lot of children who come through clinics and through and are presented with behavioural and emotional disturbance have been victims of some sort of abuse, and one of those forms of abuse is sexual abuse. So clinically, one is aware that that's one of the traumatic experiences that children can present with, and that one needs to be able to treat and use specialised services when appropriate. So as part of training as a child psychiatrist, one is exposed to all forms of potential adversity that could influence a child's development, and sexual abuse is one of those. And so one, I guess the training that I would have had is exposure to the various ranges of trauma that children can experience. And not specifically sexual abuse, but sexual abuse is one of those areas of abuse.
So does the family court require any specialised sort of training around child sexual abuse, or say like forensic interviewing or anything in particular like that?
Not specifically. The forensic interviewing is normally done by the police, and by community services who... that's why it's set up, you know, in the joint investigation response team, so that they are supposedly and are generally very experienced and the best service to do a forensic interview.
Mm-hmm. And so, and what about sort of specific training in child sexual abuse, as different, I guess, to just a general training in child psychiatry? Does this work require any specific training in child sexual abuse?
I don't think it specifically requires specific training in child sexual abuse. I think because it's not only sexual abuse that's being assessed, it's all forms of not only abuse but dynamics and interactions that one needs to be able to assess. And so being able to understand and then look at the specialised services that could be utilised and understanding how they all interact, I think, is probably more important than specific sexual abuse training.
Okay. I think that's about it. Is there anything else you wanted to add that you think it's important for people to understand about sexual abuse allegations in the court and how they...
Well, I think probably... A couple of important things is that because a parent fears that sexual abuse allegation or sexual abuse may have occurred, or because allegations of abuse have been made, doesn't mean that abuse has occurred. And then also because a parent believes sexual abuse has occurred, doesn't mean that abuse has occurred. And that it's important for parents to be able to accept what the court finally is able to conclude after looking at all the different information, and then be able to move forward from there. Because often what happens is that the court will spend a lot of time, and judges, I think, have spent a lot of time looking at many of these cases over and over, and they do have a pretty good idea by the end of it whether whether there's an unacceptable risk of sexual abuse or not. And but unfortunately, a lot of parents don't accept the court's decision and will go on and make further abuse allegations.
And can you ever say for sure whether it has happened or not?
You can never say for sure that it hasn't or has happened. And so I think the other important thing is that there is no certainty in sexual abuse allegations. You cannot ever have a certain decision, because the nature of the whole area is that there's always a degree of uncertainty.
Mm. Lastly, do you think that family court is the right place for these types of allegations to be tested and tried?
I can't think of any other court where it would be better managed. The alternatives being the criminal courts, which is I think a different jurisdiction.